and someone is bound to come by and threaten me today, or try to kill me. And we have to make sure the widow is okay. We left her house rather abruptly last night. I rose from my haunches and brushed the grass off my shorts. Come on, let's go inside and make breakfast.
All right, but I think we should start recruiting a horde now and have them muster on the Mongolian steppes. We can join them in the spring and then ride to glory.
Where are we going to recruit a horde? I asked him as we stepped inside. Frogara was lying where I left it on the kitchen table.
Well, I don't know. You're the bloody druid here, not me. But I think you should start with getting me a sufficient number of French poodles, and you can find those in the classified section of the newspaper. Hold on, I'll go get it.
No, no, don't go out there, I said. You're still in hiding, remember? I'll go get it. I wanted to see what could be seen in the daylight anyway. I dissolved the camouflage bindings on my lawn to evaluate the signature of last night's carnage. There were some messy patches of gore we had missed last night, especially on the eastern side, and I pulled out the garden hose to see how much of it I could spray away. Most of it obligingly melted into the soil under a jet stream, but some of the grass remained tinted an unhealthy shade of pink. That was a problem I couldn't simply camouflage away, because the only thing around the pink grass was more pink grass. I'd have to come up with an excuse if anyone asked. Maybe that giant animated jar of Kool-Aid met its untimely end here. Other than pinkness, there was no evidence of the violent demise of 9 very large creatures. I scooped my newspaper off the driveway and returned to the house, where Oberon was waiting with his tail wagging.
Any French poodles for sale?
He asked hopefully. I haven't had a chance to look yet, I laughed. We discussed the logistics and supply we'd need for our invasion of Siberia as I made a pot of coffee for us and 2 separate entrees, a skillet full of chops and melted butter for Oberon, and a cheese and chive omelet for myself. I also toasted a slice of whole wheat bread and slathered it with butter and blackberry preserves. It was domestic bliss there for a while, with the sound of our breakfast cooking, mourning doves cooing in the backyard, and a conversation that was little more than an exercise in silliness. Oberon's ability to distract me from life's worries was one of the reasons I adored him. But then I sat down at the kitchen table with my food and looked at the newspaper, and the worries came back. There was a follow-up story on the death of the ranger. The headline said, "Ranger Death Caused by Canine," and a subhead said, "Police Following Several Leads." The food I had been intent on savoring got shoveled into my mouth mechanically as I read. Phoenix. Lab reports revealed that the death of Phoenix Park Ranger Alberto Flores was caused by a canine, and not by a knife wound as originally believed. Dr. Eric Mellon, Maricopa County Coroner, discovered that Flores's throat wounds bore signs of tearing associated with teeth. DNA tests on samples collected from the wound detected the presence of canine saliva. That evidence, along with several dog hairs found underneath Flores's fingernails, and other clues, according to Phoenix detective Carlos Jimenez, have led police to believe that he was attacked and killed by a large dog, possibly an Irish wolfhound. They got that lab report back awfully fast, I said aloud, and Oberon asked me what I was talking about. They're on your trail, buddy, I gestured at the newspaper. They know a dog killed the ranger. How they know an Irish wolfhound did it, I have no idea. As far as I know, there isn't a test to isolate breeds. I bet you the police are getting help from someone. Oberon's ears pricked up, and he swiveled his head toward the front room.
Someone is coming to knock on the door, he said.
Don't bark, I told him silently. Don't make a sound or do anything to indicate you're here. I'm going to camouflage you again. And then 4 sharp knocks echoed through the house. I quickly cast camouflage on Oberon before walking noisily to the front door. Pausing to look through the keyhole, I saw 2 men standing there in shirts and ties. I turned on my fairy specs, but there was nothing to see. They were humans then, either cops or missionaries. Since it was Sunday morning and all the missionaries would be on their way to church, I was betting on cops. I opened the door and stepped out quickly, taking them by surprise and forcing them to step back a little bit. I closed the door behind me and smiled winningly at them. "Good morning, gentlemen," I said. "How may I help you?" I kept my hands in plain sight at my sides, doing my best to appear friendly and harmless. I also stepped a bit to the left so that they would be facing away from the pink grass. The cop to my right wore a blue shirt with a striped tie in navy and white. He wore a jacket to conceal his firearm, certainly not to keep warm, and I got the feeling he would rather walk around with his gun in plain view. He was Latino, looked to be in his mid-30s, and carried a bit of extra gravity in his jowls. On the left was the lad assigned to look dumber and meaner. He was going for a Michael Madsen attitude, wearing polarized sunglasses and leaning against my porch railing with his arms crossed. I guessed he wouldn't be talking much. He was even younger than the other guy and wore a white shirt and skinny black tie, no jacket, like a refugee from a Tarantino film. He was scowling at me because I had stepped out onto the porch before they could ask to come in, which took away one of their primary methods for putting me on the defensive. If they can force you to run around playing the host, then they get a chance to snoop while you serve them. The Latino guy answered me, as expected.
Mr. Atticus O'Sullivan?
The same.
I'm Detective Carlos Jimenez from the Phoenix Police, and this is Detective Darren Fagles from the Tempe Police. May we speak to you inside?
Ha! He asked to come inside anyway. Not gonna happen, buddy. Oh, it's such a nice morning. Let's just talk out here, I said. What brings you to my door today?
Jimenez frowned. Mr. O'Sullivan, this is really best discussed in private.
We're plenty private right here, I grinned at him. Unless you're planning to shout. You aren't going to shout at me, are you?
Well, no,
the detective admitted.
Great. So why are you here?
Resigned, Detective Jimenez finally got to the point.
Do you own an Irish wolfhound, Mr. O'Sullivan?
Nope.
Animal Control says you have one licensed under the name of Oberon.
That's true, I do. Well done, sir.
So then you do own one?
Nope. He ran away last week. I have no idea where he is.
So, where is he?
Didn't I just say I have no idea? Detective Jimenez sighed and pulled out a notebook and a ballpoint pen.
When precisely did he run away?
Last Sunday. That would be a week ago, as I said. I came home from work and he was gone.
What time was that?
5:15 p.m. Time to play the bewildered citizen.
Why are you asking about my dog?
Jimenez ignored my question and asked me another one.
When did you leave for work that day?
At 9:30.
And where do you work?
At Third Eye Books on Ash Avenue, just south of University.
Where were you on Friday night?
I was here at home.
Was anyone with you?
Well, that can hardly be any of your business.
It's precisely my business, Mr. O'Sullivan.
Oh. Are you going to tell me what this is about now?
We are investigating a murder committed Friday night in Papago Park.
I frowned and squinted at him. Am I a suspect? I didn't do it.
Do you have an alibi?
I wasn't in Papago Park Friday night. Isn't it supposed to be closed at night?
Who saw you Friday night?
No one. I was home alone reading.
With your dog?
No, not with my dog. He ran away last Sunday, remember? You wrote it down in your little book.
Would you mind if we verify that your dog is not at home?
How do you mean?
We'd like to take a look in your backyard and your house to make sure he's not at home.
Sorry, I'm not entertaining house guests today, especially ones who assume I'm lying.
We can come back with a warrant, Mr. O'Sullivan,
Detective Fagles said, speaking up for the first time. I turned my head to glare at him.
I'm well aware, Detective. If you'd like to waste your time, go right ahead. My dog is not here, nor will he be here if you come back.
Why are you looking for my dog anyway? What led you to my door?
We're not at liberty to discuss details of the investigation, Jimenez said.
It sounds like a pretty good one. Colonel Mustard did it in the park with the wolfhound, huh? I can hardly believe you'd be checking every single wolfhound owner in the valley. If you heard I still had a wolfhound from my neighbor across the street, he's not exactly a reliable witness. Last night he was cited by Officer Benton of the Tempe PD for making a false 911 call.
The two detectives exchanged a glance, and I knew that was it. Mr. Simurgian was at it again. I'd have to ask Oberon to leave him a present on his front doorstep. He'd do it camouflage, too, so that even if Mr. Simurgian was watching, and he probably would be, it would appear to be undeniable physical evidence that sometimes shit just happens.
Have you checked the animal shelter for your lost dog, Mr. O'Sullivan?
Jimenez asked. Fagles went back to glaring at me from behind his sunglasses.
Not yet, I said.
Aren't you concerned about his welfare?
Of course I am,
He's properly licensed and has my phone number on a tag around his neck. I'm expecting a call any minute. They stared at me stone-faced for a few moments to let me know that the sarcasm wasn't appreciated. I stared back to let them know I wasn't intimidated. Your move, youngsters. I could tell they didn't quite know what to make of me. Seeing the world through a perp filter as they did, I must look to them like a sullen stoner punk pretending to attend college. But I wasn't behaving like one. I was too alert, too sharp. Maybe that made me a dealer. Perhaps they assumed I wasn't letting them in because they'd find my hydroponic weed operation and psychedelic mushrooms in the closet. Or maybe a 3-foot-tall bong made of blown glass and day-glow hippie colors sitting on the coffee table. Finally, Jimenez broke the silence. He gave me a business card and said, "We'd like you to call us if you find your dog." I took the card and slipped it into my pocket without looking at it. "Good day, gentlemen," I said, giving them a broad hint to get the hell off my porch. Jimenez took the hint, but Fagles remained. Apparently he wanted to have a staring contest or mutter a threat to me. What an idiot. I knew how to be patient. I put my hands in my pockets and flashed him a fake smile. That got a reaction. He uncrossed his arms, pointed a finger at me, and said, "We'll be watching." "Please, whatever." I kept on smiling and said nothing. Jimenez paused in the street and turned around, that being the point where he was supposed to realize Fagles hadn't followed him off the porch. "Detective Fagles, we have other people to talk to," he called. What a lovely straight line. Keeping his voice pitched for my ears only, Fagles said, "Yeah, like the judge." Gods below, did this routine work on anyone? With one last aggressive clenching of his jaw, Fagles turned and stepped off the porch. As he did, he turned his head toward the east side of the lawn, where all the pink grass was. Just looking around. No reaction. The grass probably didn't look pink through those tinted sunglasses of his. "Good job, detective." Jimenez was oblivious as well. He was watching me to see if my body language screamed, "Guilty!" Then he strolled unhurriedly to their unmarked Crown Victoria once Fagles had caught up. I returned inside once they had driven off, and Oberon nuzzled my hand at once.
"I was quiet," he said,
very pleased with himself. I chuckled and scratched him behind the ears. "Yes, you were. Genghis Khan would have admired your craftiness." I lifted the camouflage off him so that he would feel comfortable, and then I sat back down to a half-eaten, lukewarm omelet and a cup of coffee I had to warm up to make palatable. After cleaning up, I set about looking for anything the cops would find incriminating, should they come here with a warrant. They would be supposedly searching for a dog, but that wouldn't stop them from snooping around either, unless I had a lawyer here. Even then, they might stumble across something or damage something in the process of their search that I didn't want them to, mostly my books. I had some pretty arcane titles behind glass in my study, with paper so old it was ready to crumble. Cops wouldn't be gentle with those if they wanted to rifle through them. I'd need to pay Hal $350 an hour to camp here and make sure they didn't look for Oberon inside my books. What a pain in the ass. Well, they should owe me some time after all that blood I gave Leaf last night. That battle had taken much less than an hour, and the cleanup lasted maybe another, so I should be paid up for 10 hours already. Speaking of blood, I put the scrap of paper with Radomiwa's blood on it inside an old collection of stories about the Fianna and locked it away in the glass bookcase in my study. To be safe, I camouflaged my herbs in the backyard so it looked like I had nothing along my fence but empty shelves. No telling what the cops would think about all the plant life back there. They'd probably assume some of it must be illegal and confiscate the lot of it to have it analyzed, and I'm sure it would come back to me half dead or worse. Fagles would do it just to get back at me for staring him down. While it was a load of inconvenience, I couldn't get myself too angry with them. They were only doing their jobs, and after all, I really was the bad guy in this case, or at least Oberon was. Satisfied that I had hidden what needed hiding, I put in a call to Hal on his cell phone and explained my extraordinary needs for a Sunday. If Jimenez could get a warrant on Sunday, then I could get a lawyer. Hal said he'd send over a junior associate to guard the castle. "Is he a PAC member?" I asked.
"Yes. Does that matter?"
"Just tell him to keep a sharp ear and nose out. If one of my pantheon is behind this, then there might be some magical skullduggery going on. The police might bring someone along who isn't entirely human, for example."
They probably won't show up at all. I never heard of a search warrant for a dog. You may be the most paranoid man I've ever met.
I'm certainly the longest lived you've ever met.
Point taken. I'll tell him.
I showered and dressed, cast camouflage back on Oberon, and slung Fragora across my back. I was anxious to visit the widow's house and make sure she was okay. Nothing looked amiss from the street. The blood had washed away or soaked into the asphalt sufficiently. Going around to the back, I saw nothing, not so much as a disturbed patch of ground. With a shudder, I considered the likelihood that the Morrigan had eaten him. Shaking my head to clear the grisly image, I walked back to the front, Oberon panting softly behind me. I knocked on the widow's front door, and she answered after a minute, looking spry and chipper.
"Ah, me dear boy Atticus, 'tis a pleasure to see ye again, and that's no lie. Have you killed any more Brits for me?"
"Good morning, Mrs. McDonough. No, I haven't killed any more Brits. I hope you won't be talking about that with anyone."
"Tish, do you think I'm daft? I'm not there yet, thank the Lord. It's all due to clean living and good Irish whiskey. Would you be having some with me? Come on in."
She opened the screen door and beckoned. "No, thank you, Mrs. McDonough. It's not yet 10 in the morning, and it's Sunday."
"And don't I know it? I have to be going to Mass soon enough at the Newman Center. But the father can drone on at times, and he keeps preaching to the youngsters what go there, all those ASU kids, you know, who have those merry sins of the flesh to worry about. So I find a finger or two of the Irish helps me bear it with patience."
"Wait, you go to church drunk?"
"Mellow is the word I'd be using, if you please."
"You don't drive there, mellow, do you?"
"Of course not."
She looked affronted.
"I get a ride from that nice Murphy family what lives down the street."
"Oh, well, that's fine then. I just wanted to make sure you were all right, Mrs. McDonough. I have to go to work now, so you can go, get mellow and enjoy your day. Peace be with you."
"And also with you, my boy. Are you sure I can't convince you to get baptized?"
"Quite sure," I said. "But thank you again for the offer. Bye now."
Atticus?
Oberon said as he trotted behind my bike, once we were safely on the way to the store.
"What's baptize mean?"
"It means a priest dunks you in some water, and when you come out, you're reborn."
"Really? So if I got baptized, I'd be a puppy again?"
"No, you're not literally reborn in the physical sense. It's a symbolic thing. Your spirit is supposed to be reborn because you're washed clean of sins." Oberon took 20 yards or so to consider this, his nails clicking on the sidewalk as we turned right on University Drive.
"But the water just gets your skin and fur wet, right? How can it wash your spirit clean, especially without soap?"
"Like I said, it's symbolic, and it's a different belief system."
"Oh, like going to church drunk is really going to church mellow."
I laughed. "Yeah, kinda like that." I put Fragora on a shelf underneath my apothecary counter, let Oberon circle around a few times and get himself settled, and then opened the door for Perry, who looked appropriately gloomy for a goth guy this morning. Sundays at the shop were usually decent business, as if all the non-Christians wanted to make a point of buying something pagan while everyone else was in church. You could always tell the ones who had been raised in a strict Christian environment. They'd put their books on Wicca or Aleister Crowley down on the counter and grin nervously, amazed at themselves for having the stones to buy something their elders told them not to buy. And their auras almost always churned with arousal, which I did not understand when I first opened the shop, but eventually it made sense. For the first time in their lives, they were going to read about a belief system where it was okay to have sex, and they could hardly wait for the validation. By the same token, you could always spot the ones who were a part of the serious magical community. They had auras that shouted their mojo, for one thing, but they also wore one of three expressions on their faces when looking at the magical wannabes buying their first pack of tarot cards. They either sneered contemptuously, grinned faintly in amusement, or looked nostalgic for a time when they themselves were clueless. Emily, the snotty witch, was the contemptuous, sneering sort. She stormed into the shop dressed like a pampered horror from Scottsdale and promptly stuck her tongue out at me.
"Emily!"
A voice snapped from the open door before I could say anything. A frowning woman stepped in after the classic parenting reprimand, "Just shout the kid's name in public and let the tone do the work." And Emily's eyes widened a bit.
She knew she was in trouble. Chapter 13. I assumed that the frowning woman must be Malina Sokolovsky. She looked to be in her early 30s, but if Emily was the youngest of Radomila's coven, then Melina's real age had to be pushing a century or more. She was a true blonde, with pale yellow hair cascading past her shoulders and soft waves that shampoo companies like to put in commercials. It looked glossy, fragrant, and utterly mesmerizing. It fell onto a squarely cut red wool coat, which would be too warm to wear for another month or so, but which provided a magnificent contrast in both color and texture. At that point, my amulet shut the noise down and I snapped out of it. Oh, she had some kind of beguilement charm on her hair. It was something the wards on my shop weren't designed to take care of, but the cold iron of my amulet caused it to fizzle. That meant it was not the everyday sort of witch's magic. Cool. Scary, but cool. Her hair really did look good, but now I was able to look away from it and assess the rest of her. Pale eyebrows, just a shade or two darker than her hair, and now drawn together in disapproval, provided a roof for a pair of startlingly blue eyes. She had a patrician nose and what looked like a generous mouth, but now it was drawn tightly down, lips painted to match the color of her coat. Pale skin. Not the unhealthy pallor of Goths, but the white porcelain sheen of European nobility stretched over a faint blush, made a pillar of her neck, which betrayed a hint of a gold necklace before it disappeared underneath her coat. Nonverbal signals are so powerful at times that I wonder at our need to speak. Without looking at her aura, I already knew that Melina was classy where Emily was not, far more mature, intelligent, and powerful, and was reluctant to give offense where Emily could not wait to give it. And I also knew she was more dangerous by several orders of magnitude.
"I thought I had made it clear you were to offer no offense to Mr. O'Sullivan," she said.
Her Polish accent was more pronounced than it had been on the phone, perhaps owing to her irritation. Emily lowered her eyes and muttered an apology.
"I'm not the one who needs an apology. It is Mr. O'Sullivan you have insulted. Apologize to him this instant."
Wow. She was scoring points with me already. But then I remembered that she was a witch, and they might have planned this whole scene ahead of time. Still, Emily looked as if she would rather mate with a goat than apologize to me, so I was enjoying it, even if it was a performance. Other customers were looking around at Melina's raised voice, their gazes lingering on the two women. They were difficult to look away from, albeit for very different reasons. When Emily took too long, Melina's voice lowered to a threatening growl so that only Emily and I could hear.
"If you do not apologize to him right now, then I swear by the three Zorias that I will measure your length on this floor and put you in breach of contract. You are in so much trouble already, you will be cast out from the coven."
Apparently, that was worse than mating with a goat, because Emily suddenly could not be more sorry for her behavior and hoped I would forgive her discourtesy. "I accept your apology," I said at once, and the tension in their shoulders eased. Melina finally turned her attention to me.
"Mr. O'Sullivan, I am so embarrassed by our entrance. I hope you will forgive me as well. I am Melina Sokolovsky."
She smiled brightly and extended a hand to me, gloved, I noticed, in brown leather, and I shook it once. "Forgiven," I said, "though there's really nothing to forgive. You're welcome to look around if you like, or if you'd simply rather wait for the tea, you can sit at one of the tables over there while I make it."
"That's very kind, thank you,"
Melina replied. "It'll just be a couple of minutes."
"Great."
She gestured toward the tables and gently pushed Emily in that direction.
"After you, miss," she said.
"I like the blonde one. She knows how to show respect,"
Oberon said from behind the counter. I busied myself making Emily's tea and spoke to him through our link. "Yes, well, she's decided to take the high road, so I'll be happy to walk it with her as long as she likes."
"You don't trust her?"
"Nope. She's a witch. A polite witch, but still a witch. She's got a charm on her hair that would have had me giving her anything she wanted if I hadn't been wearing protection. Don't take anything from her, by the way."
"You think she's going to pull a sausage out of her coat or something? She doesn't even know I'm here."
"Oh, yes, she does. Emily has probably already told her."
"Okay, fine. But seriously, you think she has a magic sausage for me?"
"How would you know the difference if she did? You think all sausages are magic?" Serving Emily her tea was quite nearly magical for me. I set it down in front of her, and she drank it straight down, despite its heat, without making eye contact. When she was finished, she rose from her chair, said, "Excuse me," and left the shop without another word. "That was great," I said to Melina. "Can you come with her every day?" Melina chuckled throatily, then clapped a hand over her mouth.
"No, I shouldn't laugh. It's just that I empathize with you. She is not well behaved."
"So what's she doing hanging out with you?" Melina sighed.
"That is a very long story."
"Haven't you heard? I'm a druid. I like long stories." The witch looked around. There were still quite a few customers in the store, and someone scruffy had walked up to my apothecary counter and was squinting at the labels on my jars.
"Well, you have a lovely place here," Melina said. "I do not think it is the right time for such a story."
"What, you mean the customers? Perry'll take care of them." I walked to the counter and put a closed tent sign significantly in front of the scruffy man.
"Whoa, man, you're closed?"
He frowned at me, but was not to be deterred. He had something on his mind.
"Hey, dude, you got any medical marijuana back there?"
"No, sorry." These guys just wouldn't leave me alone.
"It's not for me, I swear. It's for my grandma."
"Sorry. Try back next week."
"Hey, really?"
"No." I turned my back on him, pulled up a chair next to Melina, and plastered an attentive look on my face. "You were telling me why you tolerate Emily in your coven?" Scruffy Weed Man interrupted before she could answer.
"You have really beautiful hair,"
he said to Melina. She looked annoyed and told him curtly to go away, and he promptly turned and exited the store. Pretending to be self-conscious, she pulled at a lock of her hair near her shoulder and muttered something under her breath, no doubt dispelling the charm. She'd forgotten she had it on. I pretended not to notice. She arched an eyebrow at me.
"So I was telling you all that. What if one of your customers hears us talking about covens and such things?"
"We're in the perfect place to talk of them. They'll assume you're Wiccan. And if you're going to go way back in history, and anyone is rude enough to interrupt and ask you about it, like that guy who just left, we'll say we're part of the SCA. Her brow crinkled in confusion.
"This Society for Cruelty to Animals?"
"No, I think you mean the SPCA, where the P stands for Prevention."
"Ah, of course."
I shot a quick thought to Oberon. "See? Witches."
"I see what you mean now. She'd probably give me a sausage, and it would have broccoli in it."
Trying not to laugh at Oberon's one-track mind, I said, "Yes, well, the SCA is the Society for Creative Anachronism. People get together and dress in medieval garb and actually have battles and armor and everything. Lots of these modern folk romanticize the old days and enjoy role-playing. It's the perfect cover for talking about magic in front of average people." She scrutinized me closely for a moment, trying to decide whether I was lying or not. Apparently satisfied, she took a breath and said,
"Very well. The short version of the long story is that she came with me to America. We were living in the city of Srebrenica in Poland when the Blitzkrieg arrived in September 1939. I saved her from being raped, and she sort of became my responsibility after that. I couldn't just leave her. Our parents were dead."
"Ah. Your parents as well?"
"Yes, but the Nazis had nothing to do with that."
She smiled grimly.
"I was already 72 in 1939.
"You hear that? The nice blonde in her 30s is actually more than 140 years old.
She must use that oil of Olay stuff. I wonder if it will get rid of the wrinkles on a Sharpay."
"Impressive. And Emily was how old?"
"She was only 16.
"She still acts like she's 16. Is everyone in your coven from Srebrenica?"
"No, only Emily and me. We all came to America together, however, once we found one another in Poland."
"And you came straight to Tempe?"
"No, we have lived in several cities, but we have stayed here the longest."
"Why, may I ask?"
"No doubt for the same reason you have stayed here. Few old gods, few old ghosts, and until recently no fae at all. Now, I have answered 5 questions truthfully. Will you answer 5 of mine in the same fashion?"
"Truthfully, yes. Not necessarily completely." She accepted my qualification without comment.
"How old are you?"
she asked. That's one of the most probing questions you can ask someone who isn't a standard human anymore. It was one way to gauge power and intelligence, and if she didn't already know my age, then I would rather keep it that way. I prefer to be underestimated. Fights go better for me when my enemies do not know what they're truly dealing with. There's an opposing school of thought that says if you display your power, you avoid getting into fights in the first place. But that is true only in the short term. Enemies may not confront you openly, or as often if they know you're powerful, but they will still plot against you and be more likely to try something sneaky. Now, Melina had been very forthcoming with me about her age, but I didn't feel comfortable responding with the same level of candor, because telling her would be telling the whole coven. So I settled for a dodge. At least as old as Radomiwa. That set her back a bit. She was wondering if she should ask how I knew Radomiwa's age, or let it slide. I didn't know Radomiwa's age, but I knew damn well I was older than she was. Melina was smart, though, and decided to ask other things instead of following up on a line of query that wouldn't get her anything more specific.
Angus Og told Emily you have a sword that belongs to him. Is this true?
I chose to answer only part of the question, sloppy of her. No, it does not belong to him. She hissed in frustration, seeing her mistake.
Do you still have this sword he believes is his?
Yes, I do. It occurred to me that it was odd of her to be asking me about it, because Radomiwa had been the one to slap a magical cloak on it. Did Melina not talk to her coven leader?
Is it here on the premises?
Oh, now that was a good one. Much better than asking where it was, which would allow me to be vague. This was a yes or no, and unfortunately, since the answer was yes, and I had promised to answer truthfully, well, I could lie. Except that I thought she would know it, and it would be the same as saying yes while giving her just cause to swerve off the high road. Yes, I admitted. She beamed at me.
Thank you for not lying. Last question. Which member of the Tuatha De Danann have you most recently seen in corporeal form?
Whoa. Why did she want to know that? The Morrigan, I replied. Her eyes widened.
The Morrigan?
She squeaked. Oh, now I got it. She had expected me to say Bress, and then she could surmise that I had killed him with the sword that I still had on the premises. But now she couldn't surmise that at all. She could surmise instead that since I'd seen the Morrigan and lived, I had a death goddess in my five, or my circle, or whatever. And maybe the reason Bress didn't come home last night was because of the Morrigan and not because of me. But this line of reasoning implied that she knew about Bress coming to see me yesterday. How many people in your coven are helping Angus Og to take the sword from me? A veil fell across her features.
I am sorry, but I cannot answer that.
Bingo, as they say in church halls on Wednesday nights. That's a shame, and we were being so candid with each other.
We can still be candid about other subjects.
I doubt that. It sounds to me like you're allied with Angus Og.
Please.
The witch rolled her eyes.
As I said on the phone yesterday, if that were true, then why would we want to humiliate him?
You tell me, Melina Sokolovsky.
Fine. We do not want anything to do with Tuatha De Danann. Mortals who have dealings with them rarely end happily, and while we are not your average mortals, we still are not in their weight class, if you will allow me to use a boxing metaphor.
I will allow it this once. I would find it more amusing if you would use gamer jargon from now on, like, if we fought the Tuatha De Danann, we'd get so pwned. She smiled at me, understanding that I had made a joke, even if she had no clue what being pwned meant.
We would actually like to help you, Mr. O'Sullivan. We think Angus Og will be displeased if he discovers why he is unable to perform, and he may turn his wrath against us as well as you. So if you two are to fight, we would like to ensure that you are the winner. To that end, is there anything we can do to help?
There was no way I was going to let them help. I was sure it would backfire on me. But this was a golden opportunity to fish for information. I'm not sure, I said. Tell me about the Zorias you mentioned. Are they the source of your power?
When did I mention the Zorias?
You swore by them when you threatened Emily.
Ah, well, yes, the Zorias are star goddesses known throughout the Slavic world. The Midnight Star, Zoria Polushnaya, is a goddess of death and rebirth, and as you might expect, she has quite a bit to do with magic and wisdom. It is she who gives us much of our knowledge and power, though the other two Zorias are helpful as well.
Fascinating, I said, and I was being serious. I hadn't heard much about the Zorias before. Old Slavic deities had rarely come up as a topic of conversation in my travels. I'd need to do some research. You don't do any mucking about with the moon, then?
No.
She shook her head.
It's another kind of craft.
Then I'm at a loss as to how you can help me. What sort of thing did you have in mind?
Well, since you seem to be fairly accomplished at wards...
She gestured around the store to the spells she could sense.
Perhaps we could help you with some offensive capabilities. How are you planning to attack Angusog?
Did she really think I would answer that? I think I'll just improvise.
Well, we could increase your speed.
Unnecessary, but thank you. Melina frowned.
I get the feeling that you do not really want our help.
You are correct. I'm very grateful for the offer, however. It is kind of you.
Why would you refuse our aid?
Look, I understand you would like to expiate the debt your coven owes me for Emily's treatment, but this is not the sort of service I'm interested in.
You think you are a match for Angusog?
I shrugged. That remains to be seen. He has not exerted himself over much to fight me. Perhaps he thinks I am. Melina looked incredulous.
Are you anything more than a druid?
Of course I am. I own this shop, and I play a mean game of chess, and I've been told that I'm a Fracken Cylon.
What's a Fracken Cylon?
I don't know, but it sounds really scary when you say it with a Polish accent. Her brows drew together and her accent thickened.
You're being flippant with me now, and I do not appreciate it. You have implied that a member of your Tuatha De Danann is afraid of you, and yet you offer no credible reason why this may be true.
It doesn't matter to me whether you believe it or not. Melina's eyes turned icy as she glared at me.
It seems we have some trust issues to work out between us.
You think? Tell me your coven isn't plotting with Angusog against me.
My coven isn't plotting against you with Angusog.
Now make me believe it.
That appears impossible, but you have a document with Radomiwa's blood on it. I think that indicates that she trusts you at least. I was under the impression that you and Radomiwa had exchanged favors in the past and were very cordial to each other.
Yes, that's true. That was before members of her coven began sleeping with my mortal enemy.
Well, I do not know how to allay your suspicions,
she said and pushed her chair back from the table.
So I will take my leave for now.
Thank you for controlling Emily. I really did appreciate that, I said, and I was pleased to have met you.
Good day,
she said, apparently not as pleased to have met me, and tossed her mane of luxurious hair over her red shoulder as she exited, prim and stately and Polish and oh so witchy.
She's kind of like a Mary Poppins just before she turns to the dark side of the Force,
Oberon said. He was still behind the counter, but he had had a good look at her as she exited.
Let go of your anger, Melina. There's still good in you. The Emperor hasn't driven it from you fully.
I clearly need to get you some new videos to watch while I'm at work.
I'd rather come to work with you from now on. It's fun to watch you pretend to be normal.
At that moment, the door opened on its own, and the Morrigan sailed through it, squawking loudly in her battle crow form and scaring the bejesus out of my customers. Again. Sigh. When all had exited except for Perry, I told him to take a lunch break.
You're just, gonna take care of that giant freaking bird all by yourself then?
He asked, never taking his eyes from it.
The one with the razor-sharp beak and the spooky eyes that look like they're lit with the fires of hell?
Yeah, don't worry about it, I said casually. Enjoy yourself. Take your time.
Well... okay, if you're sure. I'll see you later, then.
He circled around to the door cautiously, never taking his eyes off the bird, and then slipped out. I went to the door and locked it behind him, flipping the reversible sign around to say closed. Okay, Morrigan, what's on your mind? She shifted into her human form and remembered this time to clothe herself in black. She was upset, though. Her eyes were still glowing red.
Bridget is on her way to see you. She will be here in moments.
I jumped up and down and swore violently in 17 languages.
I feel the same, the Morrigan said. I do not know what she intends. I told her I had taken Bress and the manner of his death, as you suggested, and she merely listened. When I finished speaking, she thanked me and said she would be coming to see you. Then she asked me for privacy, so I know nothing of her true feelings. She has been traveling across the desert this morning on this plane. She is alone.
Great. What if she decides to kill me?
That will test our bargain quite severely,
the Morrigan replied with a smirk. Morrigan?
Relax. We have a bargain. But have the good grace to pretend to be dead if she decides to kill you.
What if she decides to set me on fire and watch me burn?
Then that's going to hurt. Scream all you want, but turn it off at some point and she'll figure you for dead. I'll help you once she's gone.
That makes me feel so much better. Hey, I said, suddenly remembering, were you aware that Flittish came to see me and warned me about Angus Og as well?
No.
The Morrigan frowned.
When was this?
The same day you came to warn me here. When I went home, she was waiting for me there.
I do not know why she would suddenly be interested in your welfare.
I was thinking the same thing, especially since she got me and my hound into some trouble with the local authorities.
What sort of trouble?
My wolfhound is wanted for murder. He killed a park ranger who surprised us during a hunt, and this ranger was wearing an earring enchanted with fae stealth spells. The Morrigan's eyes flashed even redder.
There are clearly machinations going on in Tir na n'Og of which I am unaware. I dislike being left out. It gives me the feeling that I may be a target.
She huffed and shook her head.
I must investigate. I will linger on this plane a while to see what Briet does, but after that I am going back to Tir na n'Og to get some answers.
Her eyes cooled down abruptly, and she turned toward the door.
She comes, the Morrigan said. It would not do for her to see me here. Farewell for now, Sheahan O'Sullivan.
She melted back into a crow and flapped her wings toward the door, which unlocked and opened for her as she flew through, leaving me alone with Oberon, who was enjoying all the comings and goings from his position behind the counter.
You know, Atticus, that turning into a crow business is pretty slick, but that's not her best godlike power by a long shot. She can sense when specific people are approaching in time to avoid them. Wouldn't it be cool if you could automatically avoid assholes for the rest of your life?
Hush, Oberon, I said. Briet is coming. You need to be polite. Keep yourself still back there and don't come out unless I give you express permission. She can fry us to bacon as easily as breathing. I'd no sooner finished speaking than a ball of flame blew through my door, breaking the glass and melting my door chimes. It extinguished itself in front of me, leaving a tall, majestic, fully armored goddess in its place. It was Briet, goddess of poetry, fire, and the forge.
"Old Druid,"
she said in a voice of music and dread,
"I must speak with you about the death of my husband."
Chapter 14. Briet was a vision. I don't think there's ever been a hotter widow in history. Even though she was in full armor and all I could see of her actual person were her eyes and her lips, well, I felt like a horny teenager again. I really, really wanted to flirt. But seeing as I was the guy who widowed her, I thought perhaps there was a line somewhere I shouldn't cross. I cleared my throat and licked my lips nervously. "You'd just like to speak about his death?" I asked. "No summary incinerations or anything like that?"
"We will speak first," she said severely. "What comes afterward depends on what you say. Tell me of his death."
I told her everything. One doesn't even attempt to lie to Briet. I sort of left out precisely how I had seen Bress pull his sword on me. I was rather hoping she wouldn't notice my necklace or how much power it held, but I told no untruths.
"The Morrigan told me the same story," she said.
"It was purely self-defense, Briet," I said.
"I realize that."
Her manner softened.
"And in truth, Druid, I owe you my thanks. You have relieved me of an odious task." Gadzooks. Briat just said she owed me. That was a huge admission, and not what I had expected at all. I beg your pardon? I do not understand. Briat removed her helmet, and her red hair spilled out across her pauldrons like one of those self-inflating life rafts. It wasn't sweaty or tangled from being confined in a helmet across miles of desert. It was glorious, shining, Age of Aquarius hair that would make Melina Sokolovsky envious. A full-blown movie star dude that a team of stylists would spend 3 hours teasing before the cameras rolled. It smelled of lavender and holly. I remembered to breathe, only with some effort.
"I will explain," Briat said. "But might you have any tea? It's been a long journey from Tir na n'Og."
I leapt to my feet and hurried behind the counter where Oberon waited patiently. "Oh, certainly," I gushed. Making tea for the goddess of fire was so much better than being summarily incinerated by the goddess of fire.
"Can I say hello to her?"
Oberon asked meekly. "Let me check," I told him. "My wolfhound would like to greet you, Briat. Would that be acceptable to you as I brew your tea?"
"You have a hound here. Where is he?"
I dispelled Oberon's camouflage and told him to mind his manners. He trotted into view and padded up to Briat with his tail wagging like a metronome set to something allegro. She had seated herself at one of my tables, and she smiled at his enthusiasm.
"My, you are impressive. Can you speak?"
She was binding her consciousness to his so that she'd be able to hear his answer.
"Yes, Atticus taught me. My name is Oberon. Nice to meet you, Briat." "And it's nice to meet you, Oberon, Shakespeare's King of the Fae."
She smiled, scratching him behind the ears with a gauntleted hand.
"Who is Atticus?"
"That would be me," I admitted.
"Oh? Nobody told me you were using a new name. They always use your proper name when they speak of you in Tir na n'Og. I suppose you must make interesting choices living amongst the mortals as you do. But you," she said to Oberon, cupping her hand underneath his jaw, "I hear you killed a man. Is that true?"
I had been measuring loose-leaf tea into sachets as the water boiled, but at this I looked up sharply. Oberon's tail stopped wagging and dropped between his legs. He sat down and whined.
"Yes, I didn't mean to. Flitish commanded me and I had to obey." "Yes, I know. I don't blame you, Oberon. In a way, it was my fault. I sent Flitish to see her master." "Gods below! If she kept dropping bombs like that, I'd have to be very careful when handling the boiling water." "Things didn't go the way I planned at all," she added.
She began removing her steel gauntlets to pet him better. They clanked noisily on the table, and the magic in them was palpable. The armor of a forge goddess would be sans pareil. I wondered what it would take to even scratch it. Like Fragara, maybe.
"But now things have gotten to the point where I need to get directly involved." "Can you make the cops forget about me?"
Oberon asked hopefully.
"I might be able to in normal circumstances. Unfortunately, someone is trying very hard to make sure that they don't forget about you."
"Wait, please, don't say anything else," I said. "Let me just pour this water and sit down, then we can talk."
"Very well. Would you like a belly rub while we wait, Oberon?" "Oh, I like you a lot,"
Oberon said, and he flopped down happily at her feet, his tail swishing across the floor. Trivia. Briat takes milk and honey in her tea, just like me.
"Thank you,"
she said before taking a sip and sighing appreciatively. "Most welcome," I replied, and sat down and took a moment to savor the surrealism. I was having tea with Briat, a goddess I'd worshipped since childhood, in a city that didn't exist when I was a child. And my wolfhound was joining us. I'd made him a cup and cooled it down with ice, and he was now lapping it up from a dish on the floor. Briat appreciated it too, for she smiled and said,
"This is very strange."
"I like strange things," I said. "At least the non-threatening kind of strange."
"Yes. Unfortunately, there's been plenty of the threatening kind of strange going on lately. You deserve an explanation, I think."
"That would be lovely," I allowed.
"Here, then, is the short version. My brother, Aengus Og, is moving against me. He seeks to supplant me as supreme amongst the Tuatha De Danann, but I suspect that is only a stepping stone to something larger.
To that end, whatever it may be, he has been collecting all the enchanted weapons and armor he can. He even got me fool of a husband to ask me to make a set of armor that would stop the blade of Fragara. Not asking him why, I made some ridiculous-looking stuff and told him it would make him invincible. He promptly put it on and got himself killed. So, well done, Druid.
I didn't know what to say.
I would have had to kill him myself if things had gone much farther. As it is, I would still like to avoid direct conflict with Aengus Og if I can. Descending to the level of battle is distasteful, especially with one's own brother.
Descending to the level of death is also distasteful, and that's a distinct possibility once one is in a battle. I kept that thought to myself, however, and nodded sympathetically.
Aengus wants Fragara because he believes it will penetrate me armor,
she said, tapping her helmet. Won't it?
I don't know for sure,
Briet said.
This armor is an honest attempt to forge something immune to Fragara, unlike what I gave to Bress. I'd rather not test it.
I would never wield Fragara against you.
Briet laughed. It was like listening to a symphony that makes you shiver and cry for the joy of it.
I know that, Atticus, and I would rather Aengus not wield it against me either.
I'd have to be dead first.
Precisely. I think you are fit to wield it, and I would rather it remain in your possession. But Aengus definitely wants it, and he is manipulating events to make sure it falls to him.
You may have noticed some of this already.
You mean the firbolgs who attacked me last night? I noticed that, yeah.
I was speaking of other matters. For example, the mortal police pursuing your wolfhound.
But that came about because of Flittish, and you said you sent her.
I sent her to warn you, yes. But that park ranger was the work of my husband, doing Aengus's bidding. The police are now tools of the Love God.
They're definitely tools, I agreed.
They'll try to find a way to take the sword from you, even if you resist.
Aengus hopes you will, because the police will pull their weapons and take the sword from you at the first sign of resistance. You'll have no trouble taking it from them after that.
I see. They'll probably get that search warrant then. I should warn my lawyer.
There's more. Aengus has recruited a coven of witches against you.
What? I said. Which coven?
They call themselves the Sisters of the Three Auroras.
I felt the spike in my blood pressure immediately. But they claim to want nothing to do with Aengus Og. One of them is betting him, and she asked me to brew a tea to make him impotent.
Aengus Og arranged the entire thing with them. It is both a way to give him just cause to kill you, and a way to get the witches close to you.
But I have Radomiwa's blood, I spluttered. My outrage was sloshing over and turning to spittle. Her coven is pledged to do me a favor in return for my services.
They're counting on you not being around much longer to collect,
Briet said.
If you ask them to do anything that conflicts with Aengus Og's interests, this Radomiwa will be conveniently unavailable.
What did the witches get out of the deal? Aengus must have promised them something huge.
I do not know for sure. My guess is that he has promised them free traveling privileges through Tir na n'Og.
I gave a low whistle. That would allow them to become a very powerful coven.
Yes. But they are not the only group he's making promises to. He has enlisted the help of the Fomorians. He has stirred up a large number of the Fae against me, and I suspect he has made some bargains with Hel.
That could be a fairly huge problem. There were way more of them than me, and they wouldn't listen to my lawyer. What about the rest of the Tuatha De Danann? Where do they stand?
Most of them are with me. The idea of Fomorians and demons in Tir na n'Og does not make a convincing sales pitch.